Welcome, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and we're about to have a conversation with Dr. Jean Fio Harris, who's a professor of political science at Brooklyn College, the University of New York. She's an author, and she writes many things around the Black freedom struggle and politics of race in America. Her book, which is a groundbreaking book in many ways, is The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And Jean Fio Harris, welcome. Good to have you on the air with us.
It's great to be here.
So, may I call you Jean?
Please.
Please. So, this is an important book because we have this, even though people have said, you know, the whole question of her not being tired and has kind of been put aside by many, the real legacy of Rosa Parks is not known. I mean, which is why I think you wrote this book, right, to set the record straight about who this woman was.
Absolutely. I mean, I think certainly, you know, many people, many people have gotten us beyond the, you know, the tired seamstress.
Right.
But again, much of what we know, if you ask people to recite it, it's, oh, she was secretary for the NAACP, she went to Highlander. But not much past that. And then so even what it meant to be the secretary of the NAACP and how she was a secretary of the NAACP, because she did it very differently than many people did it. What it was she did at Highlander, she went to a two-week workshop on school desegregation to plan, you know, to try to plan for the implementation of Brown, right? That even the substance of the things that we know, right, haven't really been fleshed out. And I really argue in the book that in many ways, Mrs. Parks has been simultaneously honored and exalted and then relegated to be a kind of children's book hero.
Right, right.
And so we haven't had, unfortunately, my book is the first serious scholarly monograph on her, which is incredible, again, given, you know, how important she is, how regarded she is, how known she is, right? That when I first started it, the idea that there wasn't, you know, one, if not many, again, scholarly treatments of her. I mean, we have dozens of King. We have hundreds of Lincoln. And none of her. You know, smaller works, children's books, young adult books, but, again, not for sort of serious adult, you know, and scholarly readers.
And the idea that this is a book really in some ways of a larger history of a woman of resistance, whose life was about resistance before the Montgomery boycott.
Yes. And I think if you look at her life, it's really a story of the Black freedom struggle in the 20th century.
Right.
And really takes us from, I mean, her grandfather's a Garveyite, so our story really begins there. Right. I mean, you know, her earliest political influences are in her family and particularly her mother and her grandfather. So we start the story with Garveyism and with Southern Garveyism, which I think is not so known to people.
No, because most of it is a Northern movement with Marcus Garvey, not about the South.
Absolutely. And then her adult political life starts with meeting and marrying Raymond Parks, and Raymond Parks was working on the Scottsboro case. And so that, you know, that's kind of where she gets her start. You know, in the beginning, in their relationship, he's the more public activist. You know, she's sort of helping. He's taking a lead in this Scottsboro organizing. Obviously, that's going to change over the course of their marriage and their lives. She will become the more public activist. He will do more behind-the-scenes work. So we go from Scottsboro. She goes to her first NAACP branch meeting in 1943, in part because she wants to register to vote. This is during World War II. She is actually elected secretary that very first day. She's the only woman there. Shortly after that, E.D. Nixon, who is one of the more stalwart activists of the branch. She's a sleeping car porter, very active in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He's doing a lot of the organizing around voter registration. He comes to her apartment to bring her some materials. You know, that really, you know, that meeting and that partnership that will develop really is going to change the face of American history. And basically, Nixon and Parks are going to kind of set about and change the Montgomery branch into a much more activist branch. Over the objections of many kind of middle-class members of the branch. So if you go to D.C. and you look at the Library of Congress and the NAACP papers in the Library of Congress, there are many people who kind of object to what Nixon and Parks are doing. Nixon is elected president in 1945, I should say that. And so in those years after 1945, as they're trying to make it a more political, active branch, they come, you know, there's some controversy about that. And then she will, they will come to lead the Alabama Conference at the NAACP in the late 40s. So this is all, right, this is the decade before, again, her historic bus stand, which is December 1st, 1955.
And that, to me, is the incredible part. Taking us even back, what you mentioned, the Scottsboro Boy, this trial in the 1930s of these young black men who were falsely accused of rape taken off of a freight train when they were riding during the Depression.
Right.
And this is Alabama we're talking about, and in Alabama, and she and her husband, Raymond, it was almost as if this was their wedding present. This was their honeymoon, fighting the Scottsboro Boys for their freedom.
This is extremely dangerous, right? Raymond talks about he would, like, stand on street corners and he would tie his shoes certain ways to signal, like, what time they were going to meet. I mean, they meet in the middle of the night. You know, she describes one late night meeting at their house, you know, with guns all over the table, right? Because this is so scary, this kind of organizing, that they're, you know, and the kind of pressure and violence brought to bear on people organizing. So this is... You know, again, this is where our story begins with her as an adult, and with, again, the long history of self-defense in black communities in the South in particular, with a kind of, you know, a grassroots organizing, right? She will then bring that, and they will do that within the NAACP in the 1940s. A lot of the work that she and Nixon are doing in the 1940s are investigating and trying to document either cases that involve white brutality against black people, you know, white sexual violence against black women, or, you know, these kind of legal lynching cases. And so she's kind of trying to press for justice around a number of cases in the late 40s and 50s. And this is also very dangerous work, and she's traveling Alabama to do this. So, right, it's a very different view of kind of how we're going to get to 1955 and all of the work that goes into both getting, you know, I mean, if we sort of think about her courage, like kind of what it, all of the kind of gathering of frustration and community and bravery, right, that goes into that night and that goes into the movement that will come out of her stand, right, that takes years of marinating in some sense.
And I think that's the power of this book for me, is that is seeing the radicalization of Rosa Parks, a woman who lives in Alabama in the 1930s and 40s, grows up there. And it does show the black resistance to segregation and white supremacy. People are not afraid to pick up their guns and say, we're going to defend ourselves. And this takes us right through World War II in this incredible story. We're going to have a very brief break and come back. We're talking with Dr. Jean Theo Harris about her marvelous new book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Jean Theo Harris about her book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And, of course, Dr. Jean Theo Harris, professor of political science at Brooklyn College, City University of New York, has written this book that opens our eyes to who Rosa Parks really was, not the whitewashing we do to our heroes in America, which I love. Thank you for doing this again. I can't say thank you enough for this book.
Oh, thank you.
Let's talk about this period of time. Here she joins the NAACP in the 1940s, Edie Nixon, who becomes a civil rights hero in his own right before Martin Luther King in Montgomery, Alabama. And she joins this. She sees this picture of a woman who's the NAACP meeting. She joins NAACP, ends up being secretary. Nixon ends up being president of the local branch. And this is two working class people taking over this middle class branch. So talk about that and what this meant and how dangerous it really was for them to do what they were doing.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think you highlighted two important things. One is that, you know, I think, and other people, other scholars have written about other branches. If we think about Tim Tyson's work on Robert F. Williams and his, you know, how he takes over the and makes, you know, the Monroe chapter a kind of more working class chapter. And I think when you look at Montgomery, this has also happened in Montgomery in the 1940s. Again, Nixon comes to be elected branch president in 1945, and they will, and Parks is reelected as secretary, and they, you know, they are very committed to voter registration. In fact, so this kind of opposition to Nixon grows, and at one point he tries to institute a rule that you can't vote in the branch election if you're not registered to vote. Right, which ultimately the national office doesn't, you know, says no to. But I think it speaks to the kind of people and the kind of work they want to be doing in the branch. Rosa Parks actually, it takes a number of tries before she gets registered. This, again, speaks to her core determination. She tries in 43, doesn't succeed. Again, you know, this is about taking a test. The test for black people tended to be very different than the test for white people. She takes the test again in 44. Again, she doesn't pass. In 1945, she is angry. And so she decides to write down all of the questions and all of her answers, because she's pretty sure she should have passed. One of the other differences is that white people would hear right there at the voter registration office if they had passed or not. Black people would have to get a letter in the mail, typically. And so she's pretty sure she had gotten it right. She writes down all of her answers. The voter registrar notices that she's doing this. And so lo and behold, she does get a letter saying she has been successfully registered to vote, because she's thinking about bringing suit. And that's 1945, right? That's 10 years before our story, right? Or the more famous story. And then there's another kind of barrier in the way of black voters, which is the poll tax. And it's not just you have to pay a poll tax for the year that you get registered. You then have to pay all the back poll taxes for all the years that you couldn't vote, right? So when Rosa Parks gets registered in 1945, right, that's 12 years of back poll taxes. That's an extraordinary amount of money. So that they managed to, you know, pull it together. But this is, again, another barrier to black voting in this period. So she is very determined. Again, Nixon is sort of leading this kind of movement for black voter registration in Montgomery in the 1940s. When she actually joins the NAACP, there are only 31 black people registered to vote in Montgomery. So these numbers are incredibly low, you know, and made all the worse by the fact that black people, including Rosa Parks' own brother, is serving in World War II in the Pacific. So black service during the war, and yet, you know, unable to vote at home.
And I think that you write, when you, the way you wrote this book, you also get a deep sense of the danger. Mm-hmm. That black folks were in who did stand up to resist. And I think that's so important, because it's, again, even though we know it wasn't just this tired seamstress, it's the power of this woman. It's who she really was. I mean, she was a stalwart fighter. She was fearless. I mean, that's the Rosa Parks that you get here that I think you don't get anywhere else.
Right. I mean, so one of the things that she does is she's very committed to kind of young people, and sort of sees young people as really the, you know, who, in some sense, she likes the energy of young people. She likes the militancy of young people. And so she's constantly trying to encourage youth leadership. And so one of the things she does in 1947 is she takes a group of youth to the Freedom Train.
Right.
This is really, I mean, this is when the hate calls start to the Parks' house, right? Is this her work around the Freedom Train? The Freedom Train was basically a train that went around the country with copies, like originals of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, with the stipulation that it was an integrated exhibit. And this was very controversial in parts. Some places it passes by because they refuse this. And so this is when she brings her group of, you know, young black people to the Freedom Train exhibit. This is really going against kind of what, you know, business as usual was like in Montgomery. And so this was very dangerous. Again, she travels around trying to get people to be willing to sign affidavits testifying to the kind of brutality that they have faced. Many people, you know, even if they are willing to tell her, are not willing to sign those affidavits. I mean, so the other thing I think about this decade before her bus stand is how discouraging it is. how much they try things and they don't really work, right? And so I think when we think about how courageous she is, part of the courage to me is her ability to keep doing things, even when, you know, by and large, it's just, you know, it's just been about registering dissent. It's not been that things have really changed.
Right. And I think that is exactly true. And I think that's why this build up to what happens in 55 is so critical. Before we jump into the heart in our next segment about what the boycott was like and what she did there, talk a bit about her whole resistance to the segregated buses of Montgomery, Alabama, and other people's resistance to the segregated bus of Alabama.
Yes.
Way before December 1st, 1955.
Right. Way, way before. I mean, so first, at the turn of the century, black people in Montgomery had resisted and won a city law, city regulation that basically said that black people were not to be asked to get up if there was not another seat on the bus. Now, regularly, bus drivers flouted that. Alabama law had no such sort of provision. So we have this tradition of resistance. But then particularly in the decade sort of World War II and on, you see a kind of steady trickle of people resisting on the bus, being arrested on the bus. Rosa Parks's neighbor, a black veteran named Hilliard Brooks, resisted on the bus, ends up getting killed by police for his resistance. She had resisted on the bus, in fact, had a run-in with this very same bus driver in the 40s because she refused to pay her money in the front and then get off the bus and reboard in the back, like many bus drivers insisted that black people do. She refused to do that. He had thrown her off the bus. This is James Blake in 1943. She'd had run-ins with other bus drivers who thought she was uppity for not being willing to do this. And then in 1955, there are two young women, first a 15-year-old by the name of Claudette Colvin,
right,
and then an 18-year-old by the name of Mary Louise Smith, who are both arrested on the bus for refusing to give up their seat. And 1955 is going to be a more important year in that we are in the wake of the Brown decision. And so people are thinking about a potential legal challenge, right? The Women's Political Council, which is the middle-class activist women's group in Montgomery, had in fact written the bus company in the wake of the Brown decision saying you need to change or else we're going to boycott. So Montgomery is also different in the wake of the Brown decision and the ways that people are starting to think of a kind of even more direct challenge to bus segregation. But there is a long history. So Rosa Parks is not only not the first, she is not the third.
Right.
She had resisted before, so she comes to that moment with all of that history with her and also with the history of what has, I mean, again, her neighbor is killed, Claudette Colvin is manhandled, of what can happen to you on the bus if you resist.
We're talking to Dr. Jean Theo Harris about her book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. We're going to take a brief break and come back. We're going to talk about how Emmett Till, the Highlander School, fits into all this, what happened, what even made her stronger, and why she was in when this bus boycott began, and what happened to the bus boycott. Don't go away. Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Jean Theo Harris, who is professor of political science at Brooklyn College, the City University of New York, has written this really very important book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And Jean, let's pick up where we left off. And I think it's this leading up to December 1st, 1955, when Rosa Parks made this stand, and we can clear up some of the history here about where she actually sat in the bus. But also, before we get there, the role of Emmett Till's brutal murder in Mississippi, and her going to this place called the Highlander School, which we should talk about in a moment as well, how this kind of made her militancy even grow stronger. So talk a bit about Emmett Till first and how that played into this.
Well, I think Emmett Till plays in a couple of different ways. So Emmett Till is murdered, right, in August. He is a 14-year-old from Chicago, goes to visit his uncle in Mississippi to, you know, spend part of the summer there. He says something to a white woman. Her husband and brother-in-law come and kidnap him and torture him and kill him. His mother then allows an open casket funeral and pictures of his mutilated body to be taken by Jet Magazine. This has a, you know, this has a searing effect on many people across the country, including Rosa Parks. And then, interestingly, one of the things I discovered was that 4 days before her bus stand, they'd actually had a big mass meeting in Montgomery. One of the organizers around kind of getting the word out about the Till case, a man by the name of T.M. Howard, had begun a kind of a road tour in the wake of the two men being acquitted, right? So Emmett Till's killers are put on trial, and then they are acquitted. And so T.M. Howard is traveling around doing, you know, trying to raise awareness of this. And so 4 days before her bus stand, she actually goes to a mass meeting. So Emmett Till is fresh in her head that night on the bus. So she talks about thinking about him in those minutes on the bus, and I think that is likely true, given that this had happened not just over the summer, but it was kind of fresh in her head from these testimonies 4 days earlier.
And then there's the Highlander School, mm-hmm. and her going up to this workshop on school desegregation and confronting for the first time a place where really radical whites and blacks are gathering to fight segregation together. This mm-hmm. blows her mind.
Yes. So she goes on the suggestion of Virginia Durr. Virginia is a white kind of civil rights supporter, one of the few in Montgomery, and Rosa Parks is sewing for her at night and is, as we were talking about before, increasingly discouraged, increasingly burned out. So Durr actually recommends that Rosa Parks go to Highlander in part because her spirits are pretty low, you know, that they've been trying things and largely, you know, they have not really gone anywhere. So she takes off 2 weeks of work, which is a significant amount of time, right, for a working class person like Rosa Parks, to go in August to a two-week workshop at Highlander Folk School. Highlander had been started in the 1930s. It's an adult kind of organizer training school, sort of seeking to cultivate, you know, leadership skills, organizing skills, the idea being that local people are the best suited to lead their own communities. But again, you need those skills and training to do so. By the 1950s, they're turning their attention to civil rights. And in particular, this is 1955. So we've had Brown versus Board of Education in 54. But the Supreme Court puts off the implementation of Brown, right, a year, what legal scholars often call Brown 2, right, where we get that historic language with all deliberate speed, where the court basically turns the implementation back to the states, puts no timetable. And so what many activists realize, like Miles Horton, who runs Highlander, like Rosa Parks, is there's going to be no implementation unless people fight for it and demand it, that there's, it's not going to happen, right? And so she's gone to this workshop to talk about, you know, making a plan for implementing school desegregation. And she talks about being very scared going there. You know, it's an all-white county. She's only seeing white people, and so that's very, that's scary.
Yeah, yeah.
She gets there. And it is, Highlander had been an interracial space, an integrated space. It's about half black and white, the workshop she attends. She talks about it being the first time she could speak, you know, her opinions in front of white people kind of openly without hostility. She talks about one of the best things about it was that she would wake up in the morning and she would smell breakfast and she would know that white people were making it for her.
Right, right.
And so she sort of loved that. She loved the matter-of-factness of the integration at Highlander. She had been in other kind of integrated groups before, but she said she always felt so black, right? That this was a much more run-of-the-mill matter-of-fact, like this is just how things are done. So it very much raises her spirits, right? She's there's 48 people there. There are other people thinking about these issues, committed to these issues. That said, the last day, like any good organizer training school, they do a go-around, what are you going to do when you get home, kind of thing. And they get to Rosa Parks, and Rosa Parks says, well, there's never going to be a movement in Montgomery. It's the cradle of the Confederacy. Resistance is too high. Violence is too high. And black people aren't unified. So we're never going to have a movement. So I'm just going to go and continue to work with the young people. She had actually refounded the youth branch of the chapter, and again, she'd always been sort of seeing young people as sort of the the way forward. So this is Rosa Parks in August, right? She's saying there's never going to be a movement. It's not going to happen. So she's just going to keep working with the young people. And again, I think that speaks to both the, you know, kind of both her fortitude, right? That, like, she says this and yet she continues to do what she does, right? And that also that evening in December is in many ways about a personal line for her. It's not that she knows something, that history is about to change. It's not that she knows that a movement will happen. She does not at all believe that a movement's going to happen out of her stand. She's making her stand because it's, you know, the bus driver has crossed a line for her.
And so in the few minutes we have left in this segment, here we are. Paint very quickly the picture of what happened on the bus. But then I want to spend a good deal of time in our next segment talking about the vivid portrait you paint of what the boycott was like. But she is in the bus, sitting in the middle section, not in the white section, and dragged off.
Basically, So basically, one white man is left standing. The bus fills up. The bus driver says, all four people, that's the way Alabama segregation works, will have to get up so this one white man can sit down. And she refuses to do so. She says she's been pushed as far as she could be pushed. She talks about this. She would be consenting to this treatment. She doesn't consent. And then she also talks about, again, this is in our interviews, that this was, she was in some sense being asked to do something that she'd been asking of others. So she sees this within an organizing tradition too, this moment. And so she refuses. She is ultimately arrested. She believes the police didn't want to arrest her, that it's the bus driver that really pushes it, that they just want to evict her. So again, James Blake also acts in sort of historic ways that night. She is arrested and taken to jail, and then bailed out ultimately by Nixon, the Durs, and her husband, and they go back to her apartment to discuss sort of what's next. Because Nixon, after he finds out that she's okay, is delighted in many ways, because here is the kind of test case that they've been looking for. She's 42. She's married. She's active in her church. She occupies this interesting class status. She's working class, but sort of middle class in demeanor, and she's brave. And so he trusts she's not going to flinch under the pressure. So for all those reasons, she is kind of the test case that he and many people have been looking for.
We're here talking with Dr. Jean Theo Harris about her book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. We're going to have a brief break here in a moment, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the bus boycott itself, how it blew up and more than just a day boycott, how it was organized, just an amazing story of resistance we all should learn in terms of what we might do in our own communities today, and then talk a bit about Rosa Parks and her life in Detroit after and working with John Conyers and the continued resistance to oppression she fought her entire life till she died. We'll be right back with Dr. Jean Theo Harris. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're talking with Dr. Jean Theo Harris, professor of political science at Brooklyn College, City University of New York, about her marvelous new book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And Jean, take us to, so they're home and they're playing this one day boycott, but everything from the way you describe the creation of these thousands, tens of thousands of leaflets, mm-hmm. to how the boycott exploded, to the organizing of the kind of alternative transportation system, tell that story about paint that picture for us.
Right. Well, I mean, I think this is a community rising up, right? There is Rosa Parks' individual courageous stand, but what makes it a movement is not her, is all of these people, right, that start to act in those hours after she is arrested. So she decides she's willing to be this test case. She calls Fred Gray, he's a young lawyer in town, to tell him to ask if he'll represent her. He actually calls Joanne Robinson, who's the head of the Women's Political Council, a professor, and it's the Women's Political Council who calls for this one-day boycott. Robinson and two students sneak into the college in the middle of the night, run off 35,000 leaflets. Joanne Robinson calls Nixon in the middle of the night to tell him of their plans. Nixon then early that morning gets on the phone, starts calling ministers because he knows the ministers are going to have to preach about this to have any hope that people will stay off the buses on Monday. He calls a young minister in town, a new one by the name of Martin Luther King, right? So this is how we get Martin Luther King. At first, he wakes King up. It's 6 a.m. King hesitates a bit. Nixon calls him back. Nixon wants to use King's Church, which is very centrally located, to have this meeting, to talk about plans. Ultimately, King says yes. Everybody's nervous that weekend, right? There's all of this organizing and planning, but people are very nervous. Are people going to stay off the bus on Monday? And so Rosa Parks talks about, kind of in some sense, the most glorious moment of the whole boycott for her is that first morning, and realizing that people had, in fact, stayed off the bus, that people had, in fact, stayed together. Like you said, this is just a one-day boycott they're calling for at first. But it is out of the power of that day and a huge mass meeting held that night that people decide to continue on indefinitely. Then we see the organization of this kind of amazing carpool system. I think some of our, you know, we often think about the Montgomery bus boycott just about people walking, and certainly people walked. But part of how you have a year-long boycott like they had is that they set up these 40 checkpoints across Montgomery, and people would pick people up and drive people across town, right, to work, to shopping, to doctors. That this is partly how a whole community could stay off the buses for 13 months, which is how long the boycott will finish in December 20th, 1956, after the Supreme Court rules against Montgomery's bus segregation. And so the buses are desegregated.
And I think this is an important part of this as well, is while Mrs. Rosa Parks became the star of the movement, raising money across the country, this was an extremely difficult time for Rosa Parks and her husband, Raymond. Extremely
yes.
difficult.
Yes. She loses her job 1 month in. Raymond also is forced to resign his job when he works at the barbershop at the Air Force Base, and they forbid any discussion of the boycott or that woman. So he resigns his job. So basically, about one month in, they have no steady income. They never find steady work again in Montgomery. So she spends that year largely going across the country, fundraising for the movement, turning this local struggle into a national movement, at the very same time that her own family is in serious economic trouble. And her own family is getting, you know, regular death threats and hate calls, so much so that her mother takes to sort of talking on the phone for hours just to keep the phone line busy, right? So the toll it takes on Rosa Parks' family, on her health, on Raymond's health, is significant. It lasts far beyond that year. I talk about it as really a decade of suffering, right? They don't have... 8 months after the boycott, they still can't find steady work. They're still getting death threats. They leave Montgomery for Detroit, where her brother is. She will spend more than half of her life in Detroit. She calls Detroit the promised land that wasn't. And so she spends that half of her political life fighting the Jim Crow North, sort of challenging the racism and jobs and housing and schooling and policing that she finds in Detroit, that she sees as not too much different than the systems of discrimination, jobs, housing, schools, and policing that she had left in Montgomery. And I think that's another surprising part of the story.
Yeah,
right?
I'm sorry. And we only have a few minutes left here, Dr. Theo Harris. So let's take those few minutes and kind of really jump into Detroit, Conyers, Malcolm, her fight against the war. Not much time, I know, but let's let the people hear a bit about that.
So in 1964, she's volunteering on the kind of upstart campaign of a young civil rights lawyer by the name of John Conyers, who's running on a jobs, justice, and peace platform. Conyers is very pro-labor, like Rosa Parks is. Conyers is an early opponent of kind of U.S. Militarism and U.S. involvement in Vietnam, as Rosa Parks is. He is not favored, but she's sort of supporting him. He's sort of probably the most sort of... radical in the bunch. There are 8 people running. It's a new congressional seat. She actually prevails on Martin Luther King to come to Detroit on Conyers' behalf. King really stays away from this kind of political work almost exclusively, but can't say no to Rosa Parks. So he comes. Conyers attributes this partly then to he wins the primary by about 40 votes. So it's an extremely close primary. So King's it probably was important to that. One of the first things Conyers does is he hires Rosa Parks to work in his Detroit office, you know, doing constituent work, you know, kind of being his, you know, partly his presence in the community. Right? This is the first paid political job she has. This is 1965. She's been doing this kind of political work for more than two decades, and yet this is her first paid political position. And so she's also on the ground, right, both working for Conyers and sort of also in her sort of political life outside, as a kind of rising, you know, militancy in the city and across the country, right, kind of takes hold, and she sort of takes part in and alongside a growing Black Power movement in Detroit and nationally. So she, well, as you noted, Rosa Parks calls Malcolm X her personal hero.
Right.
Which, again, I think is sometimes surprising, right? That Rosa Parks, I think, looking at her political life and looking sort of, she refuses these dichotomies we often make between King and Malcolm, between the NAACP and, right, Black Power, right? Rosa Parks, you know, works with, takes part in all of these different kinds of movements. Ella Baker, Queen Mother Moore, so by the late 60s, right, she is very active in kind of the opposition to the Vietnam War. She is going to both things locally in Detroit, the Shrine of the Black Madonna, and then also national kind of Black Power things. She attends the National Black Power Convention in Philadelphia in 68. She goes to the Black Political Convention in Gary in 1972. She's working on behalf of many kind of Black candidates, sort of first Black candidates for mayor, for... in both in Detroit and nationally. She supports many kind of political prisoner campaigns in the 70s. Again, we can think about Angela Davis, the RNA 11, the Wilmington 10, right? She is steadfast on the issue of criminal justice, right? So this is a Rosa Parks that's much more kind of politically varied and robust than I think the picture we often have of her.
Well, this has just been wonderful. I wish we had more time. Matter of fact, we may have to invite you back to really complete the story while we're not in a fun drive.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is wonderful. Dr. Jean Theo Harris, and the book is The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks.